You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. All right, we're going to get to a segment of the program that I've grown to love in 3 weeks that I've done them, and it's called Battlefield Studies. And what you'll need for it is you'll need to go ahead and go to the website, and you'll see if you just click on the podcast page, you'll see Battlefield Study Map 226 at LZ Margo in Vietnam, September 13th, 14th, 1968, Major General Jarvis Lynch, United States Marine Corps retired. You'll see that. If you simply click on the map, it blows up through the wonders of technology and magic, and you'll see some of the things that you'll see some of the things that that are important for you to see in the map. So so that's there. The other thing that you'll see there is you'll see the a link to the article that General Lynch wrote. It would have been 30 years after the event. He wrote an article about LZ Margo entitled "The Dead LZ Margo ... The Dead Went Last." So that's there. And if you click on that, there's actually two articles that that were scanned into this. The second article is after that is entitled "Remembering Margo" by Marine Gunner James F. Donner, and that article appeared in the same issue of the Gazette. Donner was had three combat tours in Vietnam. He was a state of Arizona Veterans Representative in Kingman, Arizona, at the time that he wrote this, almost 20 years ago. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he was assigned to 3rd Force Reconnaissance Company at Dong Ha, started out as a platoon sergeant and then quickly, was promoted to become the platoon commander. So he was at LZ Margo as well. So, without any further ado, Major General Jarvis Lynch. This is the third one of these things we'll do, and I've been looking forward to it for a little while. And joining me this morning is retired Marine Corps General Officer Jarvis Lynch. And Jarvis, first of all, you've been a great friend of All Marine Radio. Thanks for coming back on and doing this.
Well, thank you, Mac. I appreciate the opportunity.
And forgive me for playing the Rolling Stones, but that's what I had in front of me. First of all, Jarvis, let's introduce people to you and your life as a Marine. Born and raised in what, Southern New Jersey as a kid.
Correct.
Tell everybody how you grew up, your matriculation to the Naval Academy. Just as an aside, I still tell people the story of when your brother was on, and please give my best to your brother, but he was talking about being a recruiter in upstate New York, and as an aside comment, we were doing the interview, and he made the comment, and he said, I wound up going back to Vietnam. I had done over 100 CACO calls, and I couldn't do it, 100 casualty calls, and I couldn't do it anymore. And then he just moved on to the next thing, and I said, whoa, time out. What did you just say?
Yeah.
And one of the legendary pieces of All Marine Radio audio is your brother, because I know very, very brave men who run from doing one of them. And to think he did over 100 is, and it went back to the safety, the emotional safety of Vietnam.
Yes.
Which I'll tell you a little bit about that. So
that those casualty calls, that's difficult business. I thank God never had to do it. But, no, he was CEO of the recruiting station in Albany, New York. And he had come from Vietnam, where he had been a rifle company commander for the bulk of his tour, Gulf Company, 2nd Battalion, 1st Marines. He went on that recruiting duty, and he did indeed. He called the headquarters of the Marine Corps and told them, get me out of here. I can't take it anymore. And they said, the only place you can go is back to Vietnam. He said, do it. Get me back. And he went back and spent his full year-long tour as an advisor to Vietnamese Army regiment, and spent the bulk of that year in the bush, in the field with that Vietnamese regiment, or one of its battalions. And when he left, I will tell you that when he left Vietnam, the commanding general of the, I think it was the 1st Arvin Division, came to see him off, get him in his Jeep and send him back down to, I guess, Da Nang to get a flight out. But the general came and told him, I have come to say goodbye to you and to say thank you because you cared. You really cared about us. And that was that. My brother's a wonderful Marine, and I would not have liked to go to war against him. I think he was very good at it.
You know, your son, Tim, who's a friend of mine, who, this is how my link to General Lynch comes from his son, Tim, who served with me together in Quantico at the basic school in IOC. He says the same thing. He says, yeah, my cousin, my uncle Chad, he said, He's a tough customer. I would not have tangled with him at a similar age.
Yeah, I think a lot of North Vietnamese learned that lesson.
The hard
but he was also, when he had the company, it was he was Viet Cong that he tangled with mostly when he had the company. Right. Then when he got back, it was mostly, there wasn't that much left of Viet Cong. And so... In any case,
All right, so let's talk about your career, Jarvis. In about in about 2 or 3 minutes, give us the thumbnail sketch of your career as growing up in South Jersey.
Well, grew up in a town called Glassboro, New Jersey, a small town. Most towns in South Jersey at the time and even now are small towns. There are a lot of agriculture in that area. I worked on my grandmom's farm in the summers from the time I was 9 till I was 17. And then that summer I went and worked for the gas company, dug ditches, making big money then, bigger money than I made on the farm. I think I got about $35 a week. But in any event, everything was, families were close. It was a different kind of country. People didn't travel, etc. The only ones that had any great deal of travel were very prominent after the war, of course, was the veterans. But up to that point, people didn't move around much and whatever. Went to local high school. The high school was visited by the head coach of the U.S. Naval Academy football team and the athletic director. This was Eddie Erdelatz and Rip Miller, respectively. They were there at the high school to see and talk with my high school football fullback, a fellow named Bruce Sturgis, who's long gone. Bruce was a great fullback. They wanted him to go to the Navy, and the high school coach, my football coach, who's also gone, Coach Smirn, told him, you really ought to talk to Lynch, and because he played quarterback, he can remember all the plays, and he also played defensive back. So they did, but I was nowhere near the talent of the fullback. But that's how I got into the Naval Academy. I went to prep school in Washington, D.C. to learn what I should have learned when I was in high school. And and joined the Navy Reserve. That was the kind of appointment. We took a competitive exam with the Navy Reserve. Went to the Naval Academy. Very quickly decided I was going to be a Marine, and by the grace of God, and I was, and commissioned in 1956, and became went to the basic school, as do all newly commissioned officers. And after that, I went to the 4th Marine Regiment in Hawaii. Was a rifle platoon leader, a machine gun platoon leader, and an assistant battalion S3 in a two-year period. Then I became, for 3 years, an assistant officer, selection officer in Los Angeles. That's an officer recruiter visiting college campuses. That's my career, a little bit out of, I had some things that were a little bit out of the ordinary. That was one of them. And I didn't like it very much, but I loved the Marine Corps, and I put up with it for 3 years, and then was sent overseas.
Just so you know, Jarvis, I was recruited out of RS Los Angeles. So I'm
Is that right?
Yep, I'm an alum.
I'll be darned.
No idea what I was getting into. None.
Yeah.
No contact with the Marine Corps, not a family member, didn't know anybody in the Marine Corps. All I knew was I wanted to be a Marine. If I was going to join the military, I wanted to be a Marine. I walked in there and told them that. I was working for Merrill Lynch, and I wound up walking into, to see, you know, and I'm talking to a gunny, and he didn't recruit officers, and I didn't really realize at the time, but he called up, and he was negotiating because I think he wanted credit for me. And they're like, and he's saying, no, you don't understand. He's out of college. You know, he's got BA in economics. He played sports. He was taking the exam. And he said, this guy will go high. And I didn't know what he was even talking about. I was just sitting there looking at a magazine. And then he made an appointment for me. And I went down and saw the OSO. So I'm an alum. So thank you.
Well, that's good. Yeah. No, and I ran into, I had a chief of staff when I was Brigadier General at Camp Lejeune with the 2nd Force Service Support Group. My chief of staff said, sir, good to see you again. And I looked at him. I had no idea. I'd never seen him before in my life. And I said, where have we met? And he said, you were my OSO in Los Angeles. He said, I walked in. I wanted to be a Marine officer. And he said, you signed me up.
Did you say, and to that you said, of course I was.
Yeah, no, but I really was. It was I remember it. And I had other ones that I met in Vietnam. These guys would say, sir, you got me here, now get me out of here, you know. They were kidding.
<That's funny. laughs>
But any case, yeah. But I had that tour and I didn't like. But then I served the 3rd Marine Division on Okinawa for a year. With no family, of course. Then 2nd Infantry Training Regiment at Camp Pendleton, where I was a tactics, head of the tactics instruction. I got tour at the Naval Academy as a company officer. Sexton, a Command and Staff College student. And from there to Vietnam, and the tour there, mostly as a battalion operations officer. A couple of months left on the tour, I was an operations officer of the Special Landing Force that oversaw the battalion landing team and the helicopter squadron.
Okay.
And I don't know, after that, headquarters Marine Corps, routine stuff, and was very, very fortunate to be selected as a Marine General Officer, because I've always said that for every Brigadier General selected, there's about 10 colonels that would have been a very better Brigadier than this guy, but they weren't known, or for whatever reason, they weren't selected. But
it's
a throw of the dice, really. But I had a tour of the recruiting district commanding officer. after headquarters Marine Corps, and from, frankly, after another tour on Okinawa as an operations officer with the 3rd Marine Amphibious Force. But and I was supposed to go to Camp Luzerne, and I was told I was going to be CO of the 6th Marine Regiment. And then a call in the middle of the night to Okinawa changed all that, and they said, you're gone to the 8th Marine Corps District and be the deputy director. And if you don't think that that wasn't a come down, to say the least, a letdown, it just blew my socks off. But I survived it, and we did well with the 8th District. And then I was Chief of Staff for Headquarters Fleet Marine Force Pacific out in Hawaii for 2 years, and it was a most enjoyable position, and I had a wonderful time, and then that's where I was selected for Brigadier, which then took me to Norway, NATO, as Assistant Chief of Staff for Operations at the Headquarters of the Northern European Command, was then located in NATO. I don't think it exists anymore now. If it does, it's down in England. But anyway, from there, Camp Luzerne, and from Camp Luzerne to Paris Island, and Paris Island to retirement after 35 years.
The 35 years, wow. Did you, well, I won't even go there, because that's, now what I want to do is I want to switch gears. So that's, everybody knows, we're going to talk about, in this battle study, we're going to talk about a fight that took place in really the northwest corner of Vietnam. When I got the grid coordinates of El Zimargo, I plotted them with Google Earth, and I looked and I went, holy smokes, man, that's bad guy country. And so, let's talk about you going to Vietnam in this tour. This is your tour as an op. So, talk to everybody about, was this your first tour in Vietnam, Charles?
It was my first full tour. I had been, when I was stationed in Okinawa as a captain in the 3rd Marine Division, 1962-63, I think it was. Yeah. I was sent down to Vietnam because we had a helicopter squadron at Da Nang, and the squadron belonged to the 3rd Marine Aircraft Wing, which was located in Iwakuni, Japan, but the squadron started making noise about security. They didn't like their position there at Da Nang. And the wing asked the division to send somebody down there, take a look at it, and see if the division could provide some help. So I was sent down there in November of 62 and found that the helicopter squadron should have been squawking a long time before they started squawking. And as a result, we trained and sent we were allowed to send only 50 people. We sent a platoon, out of the 3rd Marine Division's Reconnaissance Battalion. We sent a platoon, bulked it up, sent it down there, 50 Marines, and they were the first ground Marines that were put into Vietnam, as a matter of fact. They went down to Vietnam on 1 April 1963.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it was a platoon, Marine Corps being the Marine Corps, and the platoon being the platoon, and the lieutenant being the lieutenant. They were training in the field. The lieutenant, I've forgotten how he did it, but he managed to cut himself with a knife. And the cut got infected because the lieutenant didn't want to have anything to do with anybody taking him away from that platoon. He was going to go to Vietnam, Elder West to it. So but he got infected, and he was hospitalized. And the day before he's supposed to go, I find out he's in the hospital. I'm not proud of this, but I did what had to be done, which was, Lieutenant, where are you going to be tomorrow? And he said, sir, he said, don't worry about me. I'll be, he said, don't do anything. I'll be there. I will be there. I will be in Vietnam by tomorrow night with my platoon. So I said, okay, you got it. But when you get to Vietnam, for God's sake, the doctor and whatever. So the next day, the Air Force was going nuts. I think they were responsible for the hospital because there was a Marine lieutenant that could not be found anywhere who had been a patient at the hospital. And do you know, 3rd Marine Division knew nothing about it. Absolutely nothing at all. And I don't know what the Air Force ever did now. I've forgotten. But in any event, he took his platoon and went down there. And as far as I know, they did. They didn't, the airfield didn't get hit, and they did go on some operations to protect the aircraft if one of them went down. But that was my first time there, but I was only there a couple of weeks. After that, I went back in 68, and I think in Vietnam, 1 July 1968.
Okay. All right, so you report in as a major, and you've come from, you came from school. What was your...
I came from Quantico, Virginia, Marine Corps Command and Staff College.
Okay.
Was my tour duty. It had been a one-year tour to prepare me to go to Vietnam. And the reason I say that is because I wanted to go to Vietnam a year earlier, and the colonel who headed the people who make these assignments at headquarters Marine Corps, I knew him from when I was a midshipman. He was a company officer, and he said, you are going to school. You are not going to Vietnam for 1 year. You are going to school because the chances are very good they'll make you a battalion operations officer, and you don't know enough about that right now. You're going to go to school and learn, because if you don't, you're going to get good Marines killed. And it's that simple. And that's almost an exact quote. And it's exactly what happened. I went to the college, and I got to the 3rd Marine Division, and I was assigned to the officer at the 3rd Marine Division, a lieutenant colonel, I don't know who he was now. First he jerked my chain. He said, the general needs a clubs officer. We need an officer to run the clubs. And, he said, and you're it. And I said, who do I talk to? Who do I see? And, cause I had arranged beforehand, I had a good buddy in the 3rd Marine Division, a classmate, Naval Academy classmate named Johnny Hopkins.
Oh,
and I'd written to John, and I told John, and I said, if you think that I can do the job, I said, try to get a word in with somebody, so make me a Battalion 3. And as soon as I said, who do I see? The guy said, nobody. He said, I'm just kidding you. He said, Big John wants you to be a Battalion Operations Officer, and he says that you can do the job, and he said the following battalions need operations officers. There are about 3 of them. And I said, it makes no difference to me. I said, wherever you want to put me. And so I was assigned to the 2nd Battalion, 26th Marine Regiment. It was the only battalion of the 26th Marine Regiment that was located with the 1st Marine Division. It was kind of an orphan battalion.
Right.
And at the time, working for the 9th Marines in the Leatherneck Square area, with the headquarters of Battalion Command Post, rather, at Tontien.
Okay. Now, let me just so everybody knows, Leatherneck Square is Dong Ha, is in the southwest corner, and then you go east to Cam Lo Combat Base, and then you go north to Tontien, and then you go east again, to Fire Base Gin Lin? Gio Lin? Is that how you say that?
Gio Lin. Gio Lin. It was Alpha 2 was the position. Yeah, Gio Lin, yes.
So that's
up on the border.
That's Leatherneck Square. That's Leatherneck Square. All right, so you arrive as an operations officer. 226 is a very, very storied battalion in the Marine Corps. The only other, the operations it's known for in World War II is the landing on Iwo Jima, and so you go to a battalion with great lineage.
Yeah, yes, we did, and it was a battalion that had been with the 3rd Marine Division for a while. They had just they came to Kantian in the Leavenworth Square area from Quezon. They were heavily involved in the Quezon operation of. Was I call a winter and spring of 1968.
Right. They were up there as a regiment, yes? 26 Marines?
The 26th Marines was a regiment up there, yeah, during Quezon. But then, for whatever reason, the regimental headquarters and two battalions were taken and sent down to the 1st Marine Division, and 226 was left up there to be wherever 3rd Marine Division wanted to put it.
Got it. Okay. All right, so you walk in and you're going to be up. So tell us about where the battalion was when you reported what they were doing and what they were doing.
The battalion had positions, defensive positions at Kantian, which is the northwest corner, Alpha 2, which was a company-sized area, and then that was on the northeast side, the upper right-hand side.
Okay.
And then running from Kantian was a road that went down to Route 9, a dirt road. And down that dirt road, there was a position called Charlie 2 Bridge. There was a platoon there. That was a freshwater spring. And that's the reason that that area was occupied.
Uh-huh.
And then south of that on the road was a position called Charlie 2. And Charlie 2 was another rifle company, but there was also an artillery battalion there. And those were the positions, basically, with Kantian being a rifle company and two-thirds of a rifle company, the other third being down on the C2 Bridge area. So that would account for the four rifle companies. The 81 Mortar Platoon was at Kantian. But this was purely a defensive orientation. And what bothered me when I first got there was the fact that we were ordered to not patrol. Now, we could patrol within the immediate outside of, say, Kantian. We'd put a patrol out and run a circle around Kantian periodically. But we couldn't patrol the way you should have been patrolling. We should have been patrolling because, and this was an order from the division, the division did not have the resources at the time that if one of those patrols stirred up a hornet's nest, there was no way to reinforce it. And they didn't want to strip any of these positions that we occupied to reinforce. And it bothered me that we couldn't do that. And finally, we were allowed to do it and started doing it. But as soon as that, about that time later, we were only there for, I would say, most 6 weeks.
Okay.
That I was there, yeah.
Right.
And the other thing that did disturb me too, I must say, the battalion's combat at Quezon had been totally defensive.
Right.
Then they moved to the Leavenworth Square area, and it's back to the defensive. And what bothered me greatly was how good are we offensively? How many of the guys have been trained with offensive tactics? How many are left? I don't know. No idea in the world, but I could find out. Probably did. Got a general handle on it. But I knew that right off the top, one of our weaknesses was, probably the weakness was, we needed to go back to have some basic offensive training, which we did get a chance to do. Not much of a chance, but enough chance. But and we didn't have that many, while I was there at Kantian, we did not have that many contacts. We were threatened intelligence information indicated that on the night of 18 July 1968, we would be heavily attacked by a considerable Northern Vietnam Army force. But we broke that attack up with artillery and air before it could get underway. And that was all done early in July.
My guest is Jarvis Lynch, there's a map chip up on the website, just like we always do when we do this segment. The map, actually, I took the data from General Lynch's map, is included in the article entitled "L.Z. Margo, the Dead Went Last." And you can find the article if you just look at the website too. It's all contained in one place. So you'll find the article, you'll find the map chip that we'll talk about here in a few minutes. So just kind of finishing up the specific orientation relative to this tour as the OPSO of 226 in the summer of 1968 when it starts. Jarvis, so a couple things. Khon Tien is a bloody, bloody, bloody place. Before we came on, this is the kind of crazy shit that happened in Vietnam. Would you tell the little story about would you call it the Strip?
If I
would relate that, people would look at me and say, there's no way anybody did that.
Yeah, well, it was not a strip. The term was the Trace.
The Trace.
And that Khon Tien area had, for reasons unknown to me, certainly before I got there, had been a matter of considerable attention on the part of Washington. Some of Washington's, and this by Washington, I will call it the Pentagon. This was the McNamara line was what this combination of several types of things was called. And the Trace was really, it was a strip of land that had been bulldozed of all vegetation, and it ran from the coast to someplace north of Khon Tien, maybe 6 kilometers north, and it was, I guess, about 50 yards or so wide. Getting it carved and whatnot that provided the North Vietnamese Army the opportunity to take a lot of marine lives. But this thing got done, and then they put up towers. Observation towers, and which any Marine could have told you, getting into one of those observation towers, probably not the smartest thing a guy could do in any given day, because they became immediately targets for North Vietnamese artillery and mortars. So the towers didn't last very long. Bad idea. But in any event, that Trace was cut, the towers were put up, and there were some other things done that made even less sense that were inflicted on the people up there. But it was a very active combat area for a time. And there was, do you want me to talk about the ADSIDS at all?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Just
trying to give people a sense of the world, the things that you dealt with as an OPSO in Vietnam. And, I mean, for instance, you know, getting bulldozers online and plowing a strip, I guess, I don't know who that makes sense to. And again, McNamara, no relation, I always have to throw that out there. Made sense to somebody. And yet into this world you go as an OPSO. But yeah, continue, please.
Well, one of the things, part of this whole program with the McNamara line, they had ready-made concrete bunkers. And a brilliant idea if you're in Washington. It was a big piece of sewer pipe and two pieces of formed concrete. One of the pieces fit over top of the sewer pipe. The sewer pipe was how you got into this thing. And then the top went on, and so there's the two pieces, little concrete dome and whatever. And we had to put those in. My responsibility was at Contien. I was told to have a certain number of them. It was a Navy CB battalion from someplace nearby that made them, and these things would be delivered. And I had X number, I've forgotten how many now, that I was supposed to put in around Contien. Well, the troops were terrified. They thought we were going to put them in those things, see? Because with the aperture and the construction thing, the aperture wasn't very big, so you couldn't see very well out of it. You couldn't throw a grenade out of it because of the concrete top. You couldn't hear anything because of the concrete surrounding. And besides that, they knew when it rained and as the monsoons would soon come, this thing's apparently fill up with mud anyway. But they didn't want to be living in them when they get filled up with mud. But in any case, we put the bunkers in. We put them in, but we were very careful. The Marines were told, the troops were told, don't get excited about it. Washington says to do it. We're going to do it. We're going to put these things in the way Washington wants them done. And then after they're in, you guys want to keep your gear in them. You can stow your gear in them. But no, you're not going to be put inside of them. And you won't have to go inside of them. In fact, they do not go inside of them. And so we put them in, and it was just nonsense. The commanding general came out, and he was talking to the battalion executive officer, a fellow named Chuck Tye, and the commanding general said, "What are the troops think of this?" He said, "Sir," he says, the troops don't want anything to do with them." And the general said, "What's the problem?" And the exec said, "Sir, you can't see out of them. You can't hear anything outside of them. And they know when it rains, the gravity's going to take over and mud is going to flow in there. And they don't want anything to do with it." You can say, "Yeah, man, I don't blame them." And that was the end of that. But, And there is, if you go to Contien today, I will take great pride in saying this, there is a little hill inside of Contien, and we had one of those things left over, and they said, "Sir, where do you want to put it?" And I said, "Put that thing on top of that hill, and 50 years from now, people will be standing here wondering, what in the hell is that thing doing up there, and why did they put it there? And they will never know, we just put it there to be funny." And it's still there. I've seen pictures of it.
but have you ever been back to Vietnam?
No. I have not. I never really wanted to go back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So you now you're in the vicinity of Contien. Is that where you're at before you go on the operation that takes you to LZ Largo?
No.
Okay. Really. And then again, one other question. So as you build the narrative that way, you talked about wanting to get your guys more experience or more reps in offensive operations. Were you able to do it, and if so, how?
Yeah, we were able to do it, and the reason was that each division had a battalion landing team afloat on 7 fleet ships. These were called Special Landing Forces.
Mm-hmm.
And Special Landing Force Alpha was the one that was provided by the 3rd Marine Division.
Okay.
And the 3rd Marine Division, the commanding general had to replace the one that was afloat. I've forgotten who it was now. It was a battalion of the 4th Marines. But in any event, 2nd Battalion, 26th Marines, was selected to do that. So we were removed from Contien. We were put in a rear area back near Dong Ha, and that gave us the opportunity to do some very basic training. Obviously, offensive tactics, that's what we were after. Plus, we also had to learn about amphibious landings and how to conduct them. So we had a training period. It wasn't very long. It was just a couple of weeks. But we did get some offensive tactics training, which was what we badly needed. We certainly had to have the amphibious training, in which included a couple of practice landings just above the Quaviet River, and then we became the landing. We were the special landing force, and we were landed in the 3rd Marine Division area, as expected. And we were landed well inland. I'd say about 20 kilometers or so south of Camp Carroll, which was, of course, put us a little bit further south of the militarized zone than we had been. And whatever it was, we were landed in order to defend a village, a Catholic village. The Vietnamese had several Catholic villages around, and they really didn't need much help. They took care of themselves pretty well. But we were sent in there to defend this one village, and not necessarily defend it, to overwatch it. Quite frankly, I think we were sent in there because the commanding general of the 3rd Marine Division wanted to get that battalion landing team back, and a reason was generated to get it back. So we went in and spent maybe 4 or 5 days thrashing around in that area. We had no contacts. There hadn't been any there for a while. And then we were trucked up. Trucks took us up to Camp Carroll, where the 3rd Marine Regiment headquarters were, a big base, because it had artillery in there and all that sort of thing. And we got orders at first. And this is the way wars go, as far as I can read and talk to people about it, whatever. We were at Camp Carroll. We were told to get ready. We were going back. We were going to Quezon, out the far west. We were going to land out there and basically a reconnaissance effort just to see what was there. And
okay, and just to build the narrative, Quezon happens, you're now what, August of 1968?
Yeah, yes.
Okay.
Yes,
so you're in August of 1968. Quezon happens from late January, February, March, and by April we're out of Quezon, yes?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay, so the general timeline of Quezon. And so Quezon has been abandoned, and so you guys, in theory, possibly were going to go get dropped off there and go look around there.
That's correct. And the troops, I'll tell you, the Marines were not happy with that one. But the ones who had been there, who had served at the Quezon, during the Quezon siege and operation, they weren't too pleased at all. And I had the feeling that this was not a bad idea, at least for training purposes, just to get out there. Because I didn't think that the North Vietnamese were foolish enough to hang around there. In any event, the orders were changed literally overnight. And we were ordered to go by the 3rd Marines, we were to go to this landing zone, Margo, which was west of us. Once we got established, we got landed in Margo. We were then to go north to the high ground. Margo was on low ground. We were to go to the high ground, turn to the east, and sweep along this high ground to the east back toward Camp Carroll.
So just to paint a picture for everybody where Margo is, General Lynch is talking about Leatherneck Square. So if you go inland from the coast, Leatherneck Square is the center of Leatherneck Square is about 10 miles inland from the coast. All right, that's the center of Leatherneck Square. If you go to LZ Margo, the map sheet that you have, that map sheet, the center of that map sheet where Margo is 26, almost 27 miles inland. So you're talking about northwest of the rock pile, for those of you that are familiar with Vietnam, and you're talking about north-northeast of Khe Sanh, that general vicinity, which is no man's land up there. So, Jarvis, what was your mission up there? What were you looking for, being boomed in there and then, you know, told to go looking for stuff? Was that normal, obviously, NBA area, yes?
Yes.
Okay.
So it was.
What were you looking for?
The tactic of the 3rd Marine Division, the operational concept of General Davis, was you get your battalions, all the battalions you can get, you get them in the bush, and they get an area, and we would land. And you'd have a couple, 3 days to make contact. If you hadn't contacted the enemy wasn't there, and therefore you were about to go someplace else, and he just kept moving battalions around till somebody hit somebody. And as soon as a contact was made, then it was normally pile-on time.
Okay.
If he had the battalions available, he'd jump right on it. But,
can I ask you a question about, was there any sense of the ass kicking that the NVA had taken at that point, because Tet ultimately winds up being, you hear the Tet Offensive. It was really the Tet Annihilation. The Viet Cong are destroyed as a force forever, and then the NVA literally have the snot knocked out of them for the next 4 years till they could begin sustained operations again. Was there any sense of that, that we were now kind of in the pursuit phase of this, and we had kicked their ass, and now we were looking for them? Was there any sense of that?
That's a good question. I don't know. We didn't any sensing of it, something like that would have to be within the battalion itself. You really wouldn't know,
right?
Because we didn't. It was very rare that we talked to another battalion, made a physical contact, had a chance to chat with guys or whatever. It didn't happen too often. But the 3rd Marine Division, that I knew and frankly loved, you were aggressive, you were expected to be aggressive, and, you were expected to get out in the bush and stay there.
All right. Had you, first of all, you and I spoke previous, and you mentioned General Davis. Had you ever been in his presence before? Did you have any sense? I mean, I'm sure you knew of him by legend, but you talked about the 3rd Marine Division that you loved. He was a division commander. Another guy who's not your commanding officer at the time, but you chopped to him during the Margo operation, is Colonel Barrow, who will later go on to be the commandant. So was there any, did you know General Davis at all? Did you, or just from reputation?
I had met him once. And when I was a second lieutenant in the basic school, and we had the standard basic school mess night, this is an old Camp Upshur, and one of those Quonset huts that served as our club, and General Davis was the honored guest. And when you're a second lieutenant and you open a door because somebody was knocking on it, and you see a colonel standing there, and he's wearing the Medal of Honor, a Navy Cross, and 2 Silver Stars, that man has your attention immediately. And that's where I met General Davis. And that's the only time. He obviously had no idea in the world who the hell I was.
Okay. All right. But you understood his intent in terms of getting out there, find the enemy, and kill him.
Yes. Okay. Oh, yeah. There was no question about it. If you hadn't, what do we used to say? You're out here, you haven't found anybody to kill in 2-3 days, stand by. The helicopter's going to come get you and take you someplace else, and you start all over again. And what we were doing, and because the North Vietnamese, I don't think, had any real intention to tangle with the 3rd Marine Division if they could avoid it. And they had to avoid the 3rd Marine Division to get down into the southern part of South Vietnam.
Okay.
And the only way they could do that, other than the Ho Chi Minh Trail or something west of it, was to come down through the Third Marine Division area. And every time they poked their snout across the Ben Hai River, and somebody got made a contact with them, then they caught hell. And it was very aggressive, a very aggressive division, and a very professional one. And General Davis, and I've told you this before, every day in the field, in his helicopter, call sign Coachman 10, in case anybody thinks I'm kidding, that was the call sign of his Army helicopter, Huey, that flew him around. And he went to every battalion in the bush every day, and it included artillery battalions, and it included artillery batteries that were on a hill someplace, fire bases or fire support bases, right, they were called.
Right.
And they would also have a rifle company around them. But he was he knew who you were and where you were and what you were supposed to be doing, and he would talk about it, what your intentions were, and he'd give you his advice. And I don't remember him ever giving me a direct order. Once I was, you know, once we were committed to something. But he would say, you know, I would think, if I were you, I'd think about such and such. Well, if General Davis would think about it, it's probably a good idea for me to think about it. But in any case, magnificent leader. Magnificent leader.
Okay. Talk to us. I want to two more data points before we talk about the operation that sends you to Margo. One data point. When you were out looking for the NVA, how did you know when you had something substantial? Was it a beaten trail? Was it a stream that had recently been used, and you could tell by the foliage on each side that there'd been a lot of people there? How would you know when you found something substantial relative to the NVA?
I would say right off the top, the first answer would be deserter. One of the first things that happened to us when we got to LG Margo, a deserter, an NVA deserter. Trails, yes. Contacts. You get the minor contacts. And maybe they're trying to suck you into something. Maybe they're trying to delay you. But one night we needed air. I needed it badly. This was later on in the DMZ proper, and the aircraft came up. They were Marine F-4s out of, I think, July. Our forward air controller said, sir, he said, Dash 1 wants to talk to you, or whatever they call the guy, the leader, the flight leader.
Right.
And he said, sir, he said, squadron commander. He said, this is serious, something serious. And it was indeed squadron commander, so-and-so 6. I've forgotten what his call sign was, but he was a 6. And he had asked to talk to me, and the guy said, we were in the Z, there's a lot of hills, it was dark night, no moon, and we're asking this guy to get down low and drop some ordnance in a certain place, and I knew it was the right place, but he wasn't sure that I knew it was the right place, because he had trouble seeing, there was no question about that,
right.
And, he said, I'm not concerned. He said, I'm concerned about you guys. He said, if we drop this ordinance and we did it wrong and you take charge of me, he said, I'll never forgive myself. So I told him, well, don't do it. I understand. I wouldn't do it if I were in your position. I don't know why. I would think you would have to do it. So, he said, I'm sorry. I said, that's all right. And he said, I want to tell you one more thing. He said, I don't want to upset you. I said, well, you can't. He said, you're surrounded. I said, how do you know that? He said, there's red starlight clusters all around you. He said, can't you see them? Well, there was heavy canopy. I couldn't see it. We couldn't see anything. I said, no, we can't see. It's heavy, heavily forested. We can't see where. We can't see out there like that. He said, man, he said, I'm going to report this. He said, there's no question about it. He said, they're all around you, red star clusters. The Vietnamese were known for shooting those things to wave off our air if they could get it. So, in any case, that was an indication that, that we had enemy around us. That more often than not, it would, or not, I shouldn't perhaps say that, but quite often, a recon insert would make a report. They would detect something, and they would be watching it, and then they would report it. That would bring holy hell down on them, on the enemy. So I'd say deserters, contacts, trails, animal trails were all over. They were not a big thing. Use them. The Vietnamese in the DMZ, they had cut underneath the woods, underneath the trees, they had cut a road. It was that road that was the indicator. The Vietnamese at night, them making noise at night. Vehicles. That's another way we learned it one time, what was in front of us.
Okay.
It would vary.
Okay. Interesting. One other data point.
Yeah.
Central to the story that we'll get into here in a minute is the significance and the control of a B-52 arc light strike. First of all, could explain to everybody what an arc light strike was, and then just give us a little thumbnail of how they were controlled, where those missions originated from, because that's central to the story here. So explain arc light to us.
Well, arc light was three B-52s loaded with bombs. I don't know how big the bombs were, maybe 500, maybe pounds, maybe a little bit less. The aircraft originated in Guam. The mission, I went from, I suppose, division. A battalion would never originate one, but a division of regiment might. I don't know that for certain, but in a battalion, we never knew when an arc light was coming. Unless we were being told to get out of the way, but that stuff, I'll get to that later.
Okay.
Anyway, the mission, I'm sure was approved in Saigon by McVee. The birds would fly from, Guam, I assume unarmed. I don't know where they landed and got up armed, but they would get armed. They'd get up in a certain time. The three would whiffle overhead and day or night, and they just let the bombs go. And if you have ever wanted to feel an earthquake, be within about 5 miles of one of those things, 5-10 miles, because the ground would bounce up and down, and I cannot imagine what it would have been like to be under one of those things if it was a good arc light.
Okay, and normally the standoff distance, what was the closest you ever were to one?
The closest probably about five or six clicks. That would be when we were in that fixed position at Contien.
At Contien.
Yeah. But the one that we experienced when we were in Margot, which was a different kind of arc light that I will get to. That was probably about 7 clicks away, something like that.
Okay, 7 clicks away. So normally that's how far they would try to create the standoff for.
I think so.
All right. Let's talk about your orders. When you go to Margot, and what were you supposed to be doing up there?
We were supposed to. We were working for the 3rd Marine Regiment. We were supposed to get ourselves together. We were going to land a helicopter landing and then strike north. which meant moving up to the high ground,
okay,
and then turning to the east and sweeping along this range of hills that went back to Camp Carroll, some several miles. And that's all I remember of it. There was no intelligence information given regarding enemy positions or anything else.
Okay. So you look at your map. You do your own terrain analysis. Was the NVA, were they a high ground organization? Were they a low ground organization? Were they somewhere in between? Talk to me about the NVA.
They were all three.
Okay.
They were a low ground installation because what was not known at the time by any of us was that what LZ Margo itself was immediately to the south of a rather deep draw, and in that draw was a North Vietnamese hospital. But we didn't know that.
Okay. All right. So if every
their security then for that hospital was on the high ground. It was to the east and west and down on the low ground. It was, and their mortar teams were all over the place. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So if everybody looks at the map, you'll see LZ Margo and you'll see a circle around it. So that's the terrain feature. Describe Margo, because looking at it on the map, actually not on the map, but using your map and transposing stuff into Google Earth, it looks like the top of a ridgeline. If you look at Google Earth, you can still see the pock marks from either, it looks like incoming artillery or either 82 millimeter or 120 millimeter mortars. I'm not sure which one. It looks like a bit of a ridge line. Tell us about the LZ itself.
The landing zone itself looks big. It was actually a one bird landing zone. The terrain was hilly within the landing zone. It was cratered, I would guess, an airstrike had been employed against that knob one time or another.
Okay.
It had been a fire support base approximately a year before we went in.
Okay.
There had been some artillery there, I was told that. The ground was like concrete, except where there was the crater, and then the bomb had softened it up. The south side of, and there was a stream called a river. I think it was the Camelot River.
It's the Camelot River.
But it was actually a stream that ran through, and that stream at one time had obviously cut through that area and formed a lot of the hill mass. But on the south side of the landing zone where we had a company, that was high ground. Then there was low ground, and down below the southern high ground and the low ground, we had our mortar platoon.
Okay.
And then the northern side of it was a rim. And it overlooked a rather deep drop through vegetation, heavy vegetation, et cetera, back to a hill mass, the high hill mass that was north of the landing zone.
Okay.
And then, I don't remember too much more about it other than, I thought it was vulnerable for the eastern side where the Camelot River exited. That was low ground on both sides, although on the southern side it began to go into high ground shortly south of the river itself.
Okay.
To the north, a little flatter. I thought that was a more vulnerable area for an attack to come from.
The north side.
No, the east side.
Okay.
East side.
Okay.
Yeah, the north would be, you know, that's probably where they were. But in any case, the east side looked to me like the most vulnerable. And I remember putting the reconnaissance platoon down near, overlooking that, that avenue of approach, okay. It's called.
All right, I want to talk about the concept. So you boom into Margot, 81s and a company stay in the LZ, and then your other three companies. Now you're a four company battalion at this time, yes?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
All right. And then there's essentially, when you go north out of the LZ, there's essentially two ridge lines that head up to a point, and on the map, you're going to see a marker that says, it's kind of a red explosion looking thing. That's where the flashing mirror comes from ultimately that we'll get to here.
Yeah.
But you can see that the two axes, Hotel and Fox Company to the west and Echo Company a little bit to the east, move up those ridge lines looking for signs of NVA activity is evidently the concept of the operation, yes?
That's correct. That's correct. And I will tell you something. I don't like being on the low ground. And our idea was to get out of that landing zone as fast as we could. But it was going to take time. Remember, one bird zone, one aircraft at a time. The initial aircraft, I have read correspondence from Marines who were there at the time. The initial ones in, they did have some contact. I don't think I ever was told that. But if I was told that it was minor, we didn't pay attention to it. But any much attention to it anyway.
Okay.
But the idea was to get as quickly as we could to that high ground. And as quickly as we could, considering that high ground and how far we had to go and how high it was and what we were carrying, was going to take a bit of time to get there.
Okay. Was there any doubt in your mind that you would face indirect fire in that area, given the history of that piece of dirt?
Well, see, I didn't know the history of the piece of dirt, or it would have been a hell of a lot of concern about it. But no, I didn't know.
Okay.
I had no idea in the world that we were going to get anything like the resistance that we got, because I didn't think that they would be positioned somebody. Okay, it was a landing zone. It had been a fire support base.
Right.
Yes, they were probably watching it, but I didn't think they'd have anything significant watching it. And they could move troops around on that high ground a heck of a lot faster than we could move them around down in the low ground trying to get up to the high ground.
But the bottom line, though, is the NVA in this area, they know Margot. They've dealt with Margot before. So they have probably firing positions historically that they've used. All that is kind of the other side of how they look at this problem as you guys go in there.
Yeah. And there was no doubt that they had their mortars, and these were 82-millimeter mortars. They were registered. They had pre-registered targets in that landing zone.
Okay.
In fact, the first round that hit, it killed my radio operator. It hit on a spring, and he was down getting fresh water from the spring, and I didn't know it, but not that it would have made much difference. But in any event, it was interesting to me that the first round that hit right on the spring where they knew the troops would be probably gathered getting water.
Got it. Okay, yeah. talk about you guys go into the LZ. One bird zone, how long does it take the battalion to get into that?
I remember this was a BLT, and at the time it was pretty near full strength. I'd say a couple of hours, but given that distance, I don't recall, Mac. The bulk of the morning anyway.
Okay, and going in, is it 46s and 53s at the time? Is it all 46s? How'd you guys go in?
All 46s. All 46s.
All 46.
These were all 46 alphas.
Okay, and you said you were reinforced, but no artillery with you?
I did not have any artillery with us, no. The 3rd Marines had taken the artillery battery and put it with their artillery.
Okay.
So we in effect lost our 105s, and we had a four-deuce mortar battery also attached to us, and they weren't with us, so I don't know why. I can't remember why.
Okay. All right. All right. Yeah. So it takes you the better part of the morning to get into Margo, and then what happens next?
Well, we tried to get positions that we dug in. We couldn't do that. Digging in was it was like concrete. I can remember that. I can remember getting the companies positioned, get them organized and whatever, and getting those three rifle companies climbing up to the high ground. I wanted to get on that high ground. We weren't making any preparations to stay at Margo. We were making preparations to get underway.
Okay.
That's all I can remember.
The plan is Hotel Fox and Echo are going to move up those ridge lines. You're going to execute your mission in terms of checking out that high ground to see if there's any NVA activity, and then you're going to conduct movement to contact essentially back to Camp Carroll. That's the concept, yes?
And I remember now the four deuce mortars, we wouldn't have taken them. They couldn't man pack those things, and that's what it would have had to have been done.
Okay.
It was given the mission that we had and what we were supposed to be doing. They were probably part of 3rd Marines defenses at Camp Carroll.
Can you explain to everybody, four deuce mortar is what caliber?
It's a 4.2-inch mortar, 107 millimeters, a World War II weapon. It was called a chemical mortar because it was designed to shoot chemical ordnance, but then also used to shoot the regular ordnance, high explosives. The four deuce had served in World War II. I had my father's cousin was a lieutenant in a four deuce mortar battery in Western Europe at D-Day. And we still had them in Vietnam. It was reputedly a not very accurate weapon, and I found it to be very active, very accurate, and we had a very good four-deuce mortar battery with us. The range was just one limitation, was about 6 kilometers, as I recall.
All right. So you get your companies moving, and talk about the terrain there. How high, what's the elevation that you're going up and down? This doesn't look like anything for the faint of heart, Jarvis.
It wasn't. And I can't remember the numbers back. I'm sorry. And my map is hanging too high on the wall.
Okay, let me, so liken it to something. Is it what you'd see at Camp Pendleton in terms of?
Worse.
So higher than what you'd see at Camp Pendleton?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So when
and rougher, and heavily vegetated.
Okay.
Heavily vegetated.
All right. And you're going, and the Marines are going up and down those heavily vegetated. So they're moving in a column up that ridgeline?
Yes, they're going up. They're going in a column up trails and. By the time they get started and whatever, and they're being very careful about it. They're not just hauling tail along there. They're moving tactically. And it was sometime that afternoon that It was sometime that afternoon, I believe, that I got orders from the 3rd Marines that were being changed to the operational control of the 9th Marines, and somehow they got us the radio circuit frequencies, probably in the clear. I think it was that day that suddenly the whole thing changed. And we were told to get down, get behind this 6-1 grid line that ran through L.G. Margo, which was a quick look at the map, obvious that if we did do that, we were unable to defend ourselves from any attack coming from the north, and maybe even the east or northeast, and it didn't make any sense.
Okay. So you got two companies on the move. You got three companies on the move. You got Golf Company at the LZ along with your 81s and your headquarters element. And so that's pretty standard stuff in terms of the way you guys are moving, what you're doing, and you guys are out there, you know, doing what General Davis expects you to do, and you get a radio transmission that says you're going to revert to command of the 9th Marine Regiment, what, the following day? Within how many hours would that happen?
I can't tell you.
Okay.
I don't recall, because what happened is I argued. I didn't want to do it. And I couldn't understand why we were suddenly told to change. And I didn't want to bring those companies back into the landing zone because they would be followed. I knew damn well the North Vietnamese would follow them down. And I kept arguing with the, you know, and of course the guy I'm arguing with was, I think the 3rd Marines S3. Or it may have been the 9th Marines by this time, I don't know. But I was arguing with somebody, and he couldn't tell me why we had to do this. And the reason he couldn't tell me, of course, is arc lights were so highly classified, and you couldn't talk to an infantry battalion in the field on the radios because they didn't have covered circuits. These were all, everybody in the world was listening in, including North Vietnamese Army.
Okay, so you're still doing the I set, I shackle. You're using, if everybody looks on the map, you'll see reference marks. You'll see whiskey, actresses, airlines, diseases, all those reference points that you would go up, down, left, and right, and you would use that was the way communications was. That was covered communications in Vietnam. And so to talk about something as sensitive as an arc light on a covered net, you would never do.
Yeah, plus those reference points, that was inside the battalion. The regiment didn't know what the hell you had, as I recall. Maybe sometimes we get them from a regiment, but I remember making them up too. So I don't know what we had then. But any case.
Okay, so you're pushing back, Jarvis, and you don't get an explanation of why you gotta, you know, call your companies back and get below the 61 grid line. None of that. So what do you ultimately tell your companies?
What I did, after a while, I figured, I said, no, they're talking arc light. Now I got to get real careful. So, somewhere along the line, the guy with whom I was arguing, and I think it was Joe Knotts in the 9th Marines, but I'm not sure. But he said, you've argued and you've stalled and you've done all you've done, and the thing is, it's postponed. Everything's postponed. That's when I knew what I was dealing with then. And he said, do what you want to do, but by such and such a time tomorrow, you'll be back behind the 6-1 grid line. Well, I didn't say more about that simple grid line business, but I stopped the companies and I turned them around. I said, go back up. I hate to do this, guys. Get up. Go back. And, of course, right away, they start running into contacts.
So let me just to paint the picture. So you got Hotel and Fox Company essentially in a column, right, going up that ridgeline in a column very carefully because they expect contact with the NVA. They now get told, hey, turn around, come back to the LZ, but you know that the NVA, one, knows you're there because of the size of the unit that you're moving. Two, he's going to follow them back down, yes?
Yes.
Okay. All right. How do you prevent that from? How do you stop them? Do you turn them around periodically? How do you mitigate that?
I turn them around periodically.
Okay.
And it took them a while to get down, but then they didn't get all. Never did get all the way down until late the afternoon of the 16th. But no, I spun them around and told them to back up, and we kept doing that. Just trying to keep them, trying to discourage the NVA, I guess the best way to put it, because remember what had to be done, and I knew because I'd been told that the thing was postponed 24 hours, as I recall. I knew I had to get those guys down and out of the way of that arc light.
Okay.
All right, now, so it's a rock and a hard place, you know?
Right. So, yeah. And you push back. You know, obviously that makes sense to you. When does the deserter show up?
The deserter showed up. He showed up, I think, that afternoon. He showed up, was hotel that had him. Hotel had him. We got very quickly. One thing you could always get a helicopter for in the 3rd Marine Division was a prisoner. Anytime you had a prisoner, you asked for a helicopter, you got that thing. So he was hauled out. Sometime during the afternoon. And this is critical because we found more enemy as a result of him late that evening. And the companies had not come back into the LZ yet. They're still out there. They're about halfway down or so. And the hotel got this prisoner who was just beeping them all coming down the hill, singing them to himself and having a good old time. And thank God the company point didn't kill him. They just let him walk past. And as soon as he got past, they got behind him and he threw away. And that he was totally surprised. But he was
on his way to surrender. Yes.
That's correct. That's what he said. He was on his way to surrender.
And he had been.
And he talked.
And he'd been at he'd been at Quezon previously, or what was the story?
He said, "What I learned, what I was told about 7 o'clock in the evening, He stated that he had been at Quezon. He had been at Quezon when the Marines first came there. He had a love of life." And he was not going to stay around where the Marines were any more than he had to. And he was willing to surrender. And, yes, he would talk, and he said that we would be attacked on that ridge line from the west. At, I think it was about 8 o'clock at night. He gave us time that the attack was to go in. He was a warrant officer, apparently. But that night, when the attack went, he never got to attack because we were registering artillery to the west of that ridge line, in the valley between two ridges. We had just started registering artillery when I got that word, and the first rounds that went in, it was screams, and obviously we caught a lot of people down there, and we worked at area over.
Okay.
And okay.
All right. So we'll cut back to is it the day of the 16th when the companies are headed back to the LZ and the arc lights going in?
I believe so. Yes.
Okay. All right. So everything's
It's the 13th.
Okay, the 13th. 13th. I'm sorry.
Yeah, 13th. 13th, 14th.
All right. So so now. The day the arc light shows up, you know you got to get your guys back to the LZ and south of the 61 grid line.
Right.
Tell us about that day and let's walk through what happens in the LZ.
What I've done is I've mixed up dates a little bit. There's
that's
a
all
couple
right.
of these here, but you got to forgive an old man.
We do.
Yeah, okay, thank you. The when the companies, they spent the night out there, and the NBA didn't bother them, with the exception of the attempt on hotel. The next day, I started him back in, but slow.
Okay.
Tactically, and still spinning around and going back up, you know, and still getting contacts every time they turned around and went back up. And the arc light itself, when it showed up, there was something wrong with it. The day was as clear and bright as any day I've ever seen in my life. And there were not three B-29s or B-52s in that formation. There were two. Because you could see, I could see two. Where's the third one? There, he's not there. But so there's only two birds. It's not three. And then when they dropped the bombs, there were a lot of duds. Had to have been. That was the weakest arc light I ever heard. And something was wrong with it. I don't know what it was. I never did find out. I told one of the generals who came out after the stuff was over, and I told him, I said, there weren't three B-52s up there. There were two. And he said, no, there are three. I said, sir, it was as clear. I have good eyes. It was two up there, and they had a lot of duds because that was not a good arc light. But in any event, and it was... our troops, when this whole thing started, when the lights started flashing, the companies were not yet back into, totally into the landing zone. Echo Company in particular, and Echo Company was, they got some of the heaviest mortar rounds for the initial delivery, if you will. But, no, they weren't in, we were not behind, well, part of it was behind the 51 grid line, but we unfortunately were not able to, we were not in a position to defend the zone from an attack, against an attack from the north. And in any case, Golf Company, which was still, was going to have been left behind with the palace there, they were on high ground, and they could see across the landing zone and down that rim to the north of the landing zone. They could see North Vietnamese soldiers coming up, an infantry assault. I don't think the guy had as much infantry as he thought he had, but because he seemed like a professional to me. But in any event, I didn't realize that this thing was going on until these troops started running off of the Golf Company, running down the hill they were on and running across the landing zone. And, of course, I'm on the radio. I'm asking the Golf 6, what the hell's going on? And he said, there's an infantry attack coming up the hill. And they're going to get it. So it wasn't a very – that infantry attack got stopped in its tracks. But
so what's going on, Jarvis, is – Golf Company has, you know, like any good company that's been there for a while, they have supplement and alternate positions. You have Hotel Fox and Echo moving back into the LZ. You have Echo moving back into the LZ. The arc light's gonna go in at here in the future. And the NBA have watched you. They followed you down those ridge lines, and they've developed a plan, to converge on you. As you guys consolidate back in the LZ, yes?
Yes. Yes. That's actually what they've done. Very professional performance on their part.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So walk us through, when do you, how much of Hotel Fox and Echo are in the LZ? And it's a pretty, and it's obviously a small place because you're south of the 6-1 grid line. When the first indirect fire comes in?
Oh, shoot. We...
Half?
How far? what was the question?
How much of those companies were back in LZ Margo when the first indirect fire round started falling?
Oh, I would say maybe 35-40%.
Okay. All right.
Except Echo, I think, was probably not that high.
Okay. All right. So you got half.
A lot of.
You got approximately half of Hotel Fox and maybe a third of Echo back in the LZ, packed in tight so the arc light can go in, and then indirect fire begins to fall. And in support of an attack on the LZ, so you got Gulf Company reacting to that. Describe the indirect fire in terms of intensity.
Unbelievable. I counted up to about 80 rounds, and I stopped counting. I had other things to do rather than count mortar rounds. But it was a very professional operation. They were using the I'm an old machine gun platoon leader, so I have used machine gun terms. They were using the zone and shift. No, that's artillery. That the zone and shift method of fire. As they walked across the LZ and then came back.
Right.
And, but the fire was, that's what I would call the main battery, but fire was coming from mortar positions on almost a 360 degree arc. So, but the fire was intense. The smoke was, impenetrable on occasion. Black, greasy black smoke,
right.
And the chaos reigned. And they had zeroed in on our 81 mortar platoon. They knew exactly where it was, and they went after that. They had certain tubes working on that one right away. And
so you're the op, so I've yet to hear you mention your CO. Is he not around? Is he not much of a player in all this? Normally, an opso says, and my CO looked at me and said this or that or the other thing. He's not prominent in this, yes or no? And maybe you, if you want to leave it at that, that's fine.
He wasn't prominent. He wasn't prominent.
Okay. And that's, is that being kind to him?
Yes.
Okay. All right. All right, so as the op, so you've taken 80 incoming rounds, and then you stop counting. More's coming. Counterattack in the middle of this thing. Then what?
Mm-hmm. The counterattack was stopped at its tracks. There were troops on that northern perimeter. There was defensive positions there. It wasn't Gulf Company. It was abandoned positions from the one of the companies that had left, one or both of the companies. So they were filtering back into their old positions. And also the recon platoon was in that general area as well. So that infantry attack never materialized into anything of any real consequence. Except a lot of North Vietnamese casualties, and I don't know how many.
Okay.
But we still hadn't realized that what they were defending was a hospital. We still didn't know that.
Okay.
And anything else I can think of real consequence? When it started, I think the argument I had about the arc lights was with the 9th Marines. That's who it was, with the S3, and who I knew. And when it started, I vividly recall when that, because you could hear the tubes popping out in the distance, you know.
Right.
And you knew you were going to get incoming. It was mortars. You knew that. And
I read in your article that there was a, it was commenced, I guess, by flashing of a mirror?
Yes. That was the first. He did that a couple of times. That was his control method. He flashed the mirror, and that's what started the attack.
And that mirror flash comes from the hill that Echo Fox and Hotel were headed for, yes?
Yeah, yes.
And you all later go back up there and find Graves, battalion commander was killed up there and whatnot.
Yes.
Okay, but that so mirror flashes from that area precipitate the incoming.
Correct.
Okay.
Also precipitated ceasefire, and then again it came at 1700. The commenced fire again. It was being controlled from up there.
All right. So you talked about obviously regular NVA professionals, soldiers up there.
Yes.
How long does the mortar attack last? Any idea?
The first one, forever. Forever. No, I don't know, Mac. I'm guessing now 15, 20 minutes. I always said that we suffered 150 dead and wounded inside of 20 minutes. So it was about 20 minutes.
All right. And so now, then what? 150 dead and wounded, and I can only imagine how many guys were wounded and stayed. But you guys begin to medevac approximately 200 Marines late in the afternoon that day.
Yeah, we didn't get them all out. The next day, the dead went last, or the dead go last. That was because that's our dead were kept there. We couldn't get them out. Not the first day.
Okay, not
we got them out the second day.
Talk to us about running. You got one bird LZ, and you've got approximately 150 to medevac. How do you do that, Jarvis? Is it just simply as basic as we all get taught to go ahead and begin the triage and then get the birds in and out as quick as you can?
It's the only thing we could do. And it's what we had to do. We had to get, you can't have that kind of an incident and have your wounded laying around. And if you're not trying to get them out, what do the guys think? You know, what do we think? So we're doing our best to get them out. First thing was to get organized in that LZ and make sure it was defended.
Right.
And people were working at that. Guys were doing things that without being told. I had a lieutenant, a little son of a gun. He went out of that LZ and started one of those ridge lines, just to make sure there was no enemy up there. Or if there was, he would get him and he'd see him and run back down. He did that on his own. I found out about it 40, 50 years later. In any case, you had corpsmen doing their work. The surgeon, the battalion surgeon, who had no business being there, was there because he asked the battalion commander's permission to go to the field. And the battalion commander told him yes. They didn't tell me. He's just a doctor out there. I was raised hell about that. But in any case, we had the doctor out there. A certified surgeon who has no instruments to operate on, but he can triage. But you have corpsmen doing their thing. You have bordermen trying to readjust, get their crew. That border patrol took a hell of a hit. And we left there with about three mortar tubes instead of eight of them, I'll tell you that. But if the guys were doing their job, but we had to get the wounded out of there, and the only way to do it was bring up birds in one at a time.
All right.
And they were because of all the confusion in the zone where they were landing. This was not only a one bird zone; it was really a no bird zone because they would come in and put the front wheels down. Their front wheels would be touching on part of the landing zone. The fantail would be up a little bit.
Because of the slope.
Because of terrain.
Right.
And we're getting them in, and I can remember one of those helicopters. I'm trying to watch several things at once and be useful, but in any case, this one helicopter, I realized suddenly that he's got a lot of wounded in there, a hell of a lot of wounded. And I told the air officer, tell him to close the door and get the hell out of here. He's overloaded. And the fact said something to the pilot. Pilot said something back. And he turned to me. He said, "No, sir." He said, "He's not overloaded." I said, "Tell him he's overloaded. Get his ass out of here now." And that helicopter, the back ramp went up, and that helicopter, I'll never forget it. It looked like a praying mantis. That's what it reminded me of at the time, a praying mantis. He got the nose off the ground, and the nose started going right, then left, then right, in arcs. And like he said, an animal looking, praying mantis looking for an escape from something. Like, and all he was doing just trying to get that thing off the damn ground. And he got it up, and that thing, I remember I told you the golf company running across the landing zone to clash head on with this infantry assault. Those same troops are now running across the landing zone because the helicopter's gotten up, he's over the trees, and he's sliding down, literally sliding down that north slope before he hits the high ground. And all I could think of was, God, my God, we're going to have a helicopter. We got to get down there. We're going to have to get down there. And I knew we got to fight our way down there. And suddenly, he disappeared. Then he came up, and he flew back across that landing zone. And all he was doing, he was pumping fuel out of the back. I could see jets of fuel going out behind him. But in any case, that was the last bird off the ground. And off in the distance, poof, could hear a mortar came, a mortar round gone down the tube, and that mortar round landed right where those evacuation helicopters had been landing or touching down with their front wheels. And that son of a gun up there on that hill was telling me, "I'm a pro, I let you do this." But in any event, we got him out the next day.
So, Jarvis, let's just say that there was 10 Marines put on each one of those birds. That's 1546 moved in and out of Margo, and you take no indirect fire during the time you're running the medevac.
When we were running the medevac, no.
Wow.
None. And the next day when I had several visitors the next day, but the Army General, Lieutenant General Stilwell, who was Commanding General of 2-4 Corps, I think I mentioned this earlier,
yep.
He came out there, and I had met him before when we were at Contien, but in any event, he looked around and he said, "Major, how's their morale?" And I said, "Sir, I haven't thought about that." I said, "They're Marines. I haven't thought about it." And he looked around, and here was an 81-millimeter mortar platoon, one of the troops in the platoon, walking along carrying a box of 81 mortar ammo over his shoulder, whistling. And a couple of others, they were policing up, and they were doing all the stuff that they were supposed to be doing. He looked at them, and he looked at me, and he started to cry.
I'm not sure what other reaction you could have when you see that kind of courage and that kind of steadfastness. I want to talk about some of the other visitors you had. The CO of the 9th Marine Regiment at the time is Colonel Barrow. He flies out. Talk about him. Did he fly out the day of the attack, the following morning? Talk about what it meant for him to be there, and what did he tell you?
Well, he came out, I think it was the following morning. And, because he came out there a couple of times, I gotta get him sorted out. I don't recall exactly. He knew my arguments about the arc light. He knew about that. And we talked about it. I think he's the one I told that wasn't much of an arc light. There's something wrong with that whole thing. But in any event, that regiment, the 9th Marines at the time, and I knew this. No, I learned it. No, I knew it the day we were attacked. At about the same time we were attacked, an Army Special Forces thing, someplace, I never knew where it was, which was under the responsibility of the 9th Marines. That thing got attacked at the same time. Because when it started on LZ Margo, I remember picking up the handset and calling the three of the 9th Marines, and I gave him my opinion of his lineage. And Cecil, or I shouldn't say that. But in any case, I gave him my opinion of a lot of things, and he was very upset at what was happening to us, because I held the thing up so I could hear the mortars. And he said something about, you're not the only one we got trouble with, and that was it, so I didn't bother him anymore. But I don't remember exactly what Colonel Barrow said at the time. I really don't. I just remember I had a tremendous amount of respect for him, and he came out later. It's another case in point. He came out later, a couple of days later, gave me an operations order, brought his fancy map with him and all that, and told me what he wanted done. And I told him I thought there was a better way of doing it, and I proposed a better way to do it. And he said, I don't care how you do it, son, just get it done. And geez, 3-4 hours later, we get another operations order sending us someplace else, back to the 3rd Marine Regiment, to someplace else up in the DMZ. So, in any event, I don't know. General Davis, I can remember talking to him, and he had not been briefed that the NVA had attempted an infantry attack on us. But in any case, when we went back up the hill, we started back up the damn hill again.
So hold on, just so everybody understands that. So you run the medevacs, you took a pretty good shot, but you're still out there with the mission, and so you return back to the mission and you head up that hill again, yes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. Starting back up. Yeah,
all right.
And that's when we found out it was a hospital in there.
Okay.
And we also golf company going back up on that left fork. Golf back up there. They needed to work anyway. And golf. I wanted to hold up at a certain point on their way back up for the night. And I remember the guy called me up. And he said, sir, it smells so bad. We got to keep going. He said that whatever that arty hit that the hotel was shooting, he said that it stinks up here real bad. I said, okay, keep going. But they got up on the top. And when they got going up to the top, it was a stairway. The guy, Golf 6 called me. He said, I'm looking at the stairway to the stars. And I said, what are you talking about? He said, we're not quite at the top, but he said, now we're going to go up the stair steps that take us to the top. And, oh, by the way, it looks like there's a hospital down there. And we sent guys down, and I'm afraid, honest, but we meant no harm, but I'm afraid that what that guy reported as an attack that we were going to get from that direction was, in fact, the hospital being evacuated. But I don't know that for sure. There were no patients in the hospital when we got there. And
that's where the smell was coming from.
No, it was coming from the night that hotel spent up there, and he was calling. We were registering a night fire.
And
we caught him in that draw, and okay. Just worked it. We just blew that draw away. I didn't fool around with it, but yeah.
All right, so now you're in the middle of conducting those operations. Do you finish that mission? How does this culminate, Jarvis?
It culminated by us getting an order, an op order, to go back to the 3rd Marine Regiment. We chopped back to them, And the helicopters would come get us, which they did. And they took us to another, quote, one bird landing zone.
Oh, my God.
End quote. In the middle of the DZ, north of Camp Carroll. I forgot. It's not shown on my map. I lost it somewhere, and I don't know exactly where it was now. But that LZ, that mission, rather, involved a road that the North Vietnamese had cut under the canopy. We replaced two companies of, I believe, it the 4th Marines. We went in, and they were glad to see us. We weren't necessarily glad to see them, but they were glad to see us. But in any event, now you now have a very understrength infantry organization. It's called a battalion landing team. The Echo Company's got 30, 35 guys. Each of the other three had about 60 apiece. We have two or three mortars, 81 mortars. The recon platoon's about half strength, and the engineer platoon's about half strength. It was not a very strong outfit, particularly infantry-wise, but a TPQ, time phase something or other. At night, they would occasionally fly around, and I don't know who picked the targets or why they were picked or whatever. I have no idea in the world. But an aircraft would be up there, and it was all controlled electronically. And at a certain point, the airplanes would drop. This is an attack bird, a single-engine attack jet. And one of those TPQs had knocked down some trees, which exposed this road in the demilitarized zone. Two companies of the 4th Marines had apparently been put in there. I don't know why, other than to see what's going on. But what they heard at night was engines, motors, and a lot of them. And that's when it was decided that we just better get those two companies out there, put a battalion in, understrength or not. And so that's where we went. And the landing zone in which we landed consisted of a big tree that had been knocked down by a bomb. And the bomb and the tree fell across the bomb crater, and the tree was the landing zone. If the pilot would put his front wheels on the landing on the tree, and open the ramp on the back, and the troops would jump out the back. And of course, as each troop jumped, the back raised higher. And the last man out, the first guy in, last man out, which in the case of mine happened to be me, I looked down, I got about 10, 12 foot drop with a 70, 80 pound pack on down in the landing zone, or down into that crater, but fortunately the bomb had loosened the soil. Nobody got hurt doing that. But, somewhere in that area they had a forward observer because we started taking artillery, by the way. And so we had more fun there. And what we attacked eventually and overran was an artillery position in the DMZ. And you're doing your best. And you're accomplishing your mission. You have 15,476 things to think about and do. And there's somebody on your ass about, how do you know it's artillery? What do you mean they have artillery there? They say at the Paris peace talks they don't have any artillery there. Now, that's how far that information went, that fast. The peace talks were going on. We report this artillery in a god-awful number of rounds. And we're being asked about it. How do you know it's artillery? Well, they got a barrel. It's got a barrel, you know. It's got a door you open in the back, and it's got all these bullets laid on the side. How often you put up with this shit? Then we overran it.
It seems like a fairly regular event, though, Jarvis, that these kind of things, somebody's understanding based on either what they read in the newspaper crops up in your face as a tactical leader in Vietnam, and it just sounds crazy when you hear somebody say that. What do you mean? They say at the Paris Peace Talks, there's no artillery up there. So either somebody's trying to be funny, and in this case probably the inappropriate venue, or somebody's stupid and it's hard to believe.
No, I don't know. They wanted confirmation. My guess always was that all the confirmation they were looking for, these dumbass questions, were coming from either Saigon or Washington, and they were just trying to do their job. But in any event, we had a little trouble there. We were out from under the artillery fan, the U.S. Marine artillery fan, and we were taking incoming artillery. And that's the first night we were there, and it was quite accurate, so long as the sun was up.
Okay, I want to, so you go from Margo to that operation.
Yeah.
Wow. All right, so I want to talk about lessons learned now, Jarvis. You have a long, illustrious career in the Marine Corps. Obviously, you wrote about Margo in, 1996, I think, is the article?
Yes.
So obviously, you know, like all leaders that are involved in operations and days that they never forget. Talk to me about your responsibility in terms of dissent. Did you do enough? Are you okay with that? Did you fail in terms of I didn't get the message across what was going to happen that I knew was going to happen? And should you have obeyed that order? Talk to me about all that, because I can imagine that in your life you spent no small amount of time thinking about that.
Oh, yeah. No, regarding the dissent.
Talk to me about dissent and the arc light, in terms of that.
The arc light, I never regretted doing what I did. I regretted it had to happen, but I couldn't leave those troops out there because I didn't know exactly where it was going. And the maps that we look at and whatever, they aren't the most accurate maps in the world.
Right.
And they don't necessarily, particularly up in that DMZ area where the terrain got rough, the Frenchmen who made the maps, and that's where they came from, I think they got a little tired up there. And the terrain didn't always match exactly what the map said it was supposed to be. So you couldn't rely on total accuracy, and you couldn't fool around with an arc light. It's that simple. Even as it turned out, that arc light that went in, I think we would have been perfectly all right if we had just stayed up and just got on a high ground and stayed there. But I can't say that for sure because I never knew exactly where they landed. I just know it was not a good arc light. It would have been good if we were up there and it didn't land on any of us. But I mean, you can't put people that kind of harm. To be responsible for guys that are dying, who are going to die, or be wounded badly, or maybe if they're lucky, you're going to get to go home. You got to look after them. But you still have to do the mission. But the thing is, when doing the mission, give it everything you got. Give it everything you got and everything you can get from anybody else. And I'm talking about artillery, mortars, airplanes. I don't give a damn what it is. Get it and use it. We used to every morning, our call sign was John Brown. That was the battalion, John Brown. I was John Brown 3. And every morning, John Brown 3 would call Brown, each one of those company commanders, each one of the leaders out there who had a radio, and say, this is John Brown 3, and today is, John Brown 3 Save a Grunt Day, or John Brown Save a Grunt Day. And they all knew what Save a Grunt meant. And I'd say, Save a Grunt. Air, artillery, naval gunfire, everything. Save a Grunt. The American public can always give you more bullets they won't willingly give you more sons, you know, and that as almost every day, that or something like it, and we use supporting arms like nobody's business, and took some risks with it, but risk it with an arc light, no, never.
All right. Talk to young officers about, I had a conversation with a guy named Nick War, first lieutenant at Hue. He lost 30 of 50 Marines trying to conduct three frontal attacks across Phase Lang Green with 1st Battalion, 5th Marine. And talk about the intellectual rigor that goes into that. Do you, when you're the operations officer, do you need to apologize to anybody for arguing with them or vehemently articulating your position relative to a tactical event that possibly is going to get anybody killed? Do you need to start the sentence with all due respect, or is it your moral obligation to vent your spleen and worry about feelings later?
That's my opinion. You get to you vent your spleen, you state your case in terms that everybody will understand, and there's no mistaking what you mean when you say what you said. And if they don't like it, that's too damn bad. And if they want to retaliate, well, if they're that small, they're that small. That's their problem, not mine.
Okay, but in the high stakes business that is, you bet your life when we go to war, that's your moral obligation. And ultimately, if you're going to put your head on your pillow and be able to sleep for the rest of your life, you have to do that.
You do. I could tell you one. It was an operation I often think about where I didn't do what I should have done. And I look back on it. It was in the 1st Division's area, Mead River. And it was a huge cordon operation. And we were the closest one to the enemy that was inside the cordon. And I had this, my opinion, this raggedy-ass battalion landing team still under strength. We haven't got any replacements yet. From what we lost in the embargo and the DMZ, we still don't have replacements. Still under strength battalion. And I toyed with the idea. I knew how to crack into that thing. The enemy had bunkers. It had concrete bunkers in there.
Oh.
And I couldn't figure out where the hell they came. How did you get concrete bunkers? What a fool I was. 50 years later, I found out, easy. USAID, that's how I got the concrete. He bought it. Down on the market. You know, somebody told me that, you dumbass. Can't you figure that out for yourself? I said, no, I never did. I never thought of that. I never saw a market. So, but in any case, we had in the rear, we had a tank platoon, you know, we had a four-deuce mortar platoon. And I had a lot of stuff that the other battalions didn't have. And, I didn't offer. I thought, you know, if they ask me, if they tell me to do it, I will know how to do it. I'm not going to offer to do it because I'm not going to offer my guys' lives up just to do this. And I don't know. There's a lot of guys who would argue with me on that one. But I think, and they probably have a good point, but I just didn't feel that scolding into the regimental CP and offering up the opportunity for them to watch us go in there with tanks, including a flame tank and flamethrowers and all that stuff, and just doing a number on this outfit when it was going to cost us because they were inside of bunkers and they had a lot of people in there. They were probably outnumbered us, as a matter of fact. But anyway, that's the one that I look back on sometimes and say, yes, did you do that one right, or should you have volunteered? And I'm still up in the air about it, but it doesn't make any difference anymore. I don't have to worry about it. But no, otherwise, you have a responsibility to troops, and you have to do what you have to do.
Okay, I want to ask you one more question about the whole decision making and your moral obligation to and I don't think you need to say with all due respect, okay? Just be respectful and in an articulate and emphatic way, tell them what you think, because you're the guy there, right? You're the guy there. And, you know, I went through this earlier this week with somebody saying, geez, isn't it terrible that in the calls just released, the command center down in Florida tells the sheriffs there to form a perimeter and not go in there. I said, first of all, as somebody who's run operation centers, the commander on the ground, he trumps you in the early phase of that. You don't know what's going on. He knows more than you. And all he has to say is, hey, I'm headed into the building. He's still in there shooting out. And your response is, got it. Okay?
Yes.
You know more there than they do there. So that's where the moral obligation, you got to vent your spleen, because most of the time, guys that are planning in operations like this, they're operating, you know, with the reporting they have, with the situation that they have in front of them, with the maps that you help generate. And so their knowledge may not be perfect, and don't assume that it is, and that's why you got to talk.
Yeah.
But I want to talk, when you get to the salute point, Jarvis, when you get to the shut up and color point, then what? Shut up and color? It's not a democracy, it's combat?
No, example. And maybe it's who you're dealing with as well, in your assessment of that. Example, Colonel Barrow told us, the helicopters are going to come at whatever time it was the next morning, and they're going to lift you over there, and I want you to tack and do this, that, and the other. And he said, you understand me? And I said, sir, I understand you, but sir, I don't agree. I'd like to say the way I want to do it. And so I explained to him why I wanted to, what I wanted to do and why I wanted to do it. And he said, son, do it your way. Just get it done.
Okay. Now, again, just for everybody, that's Major Jarvis Lynch talking to Colonel Bob Barrow, right? World War II, right? Chosen Reservoir, Bob Barrow, okay?
Yeah.
How did that feel when you decided you needed to vent your spleen to him?
It didn't bother me. Okay. It was duty. I don't think I even gave it a second's worth of thought. It wasn't what he wanted me to do. The way he wanted it done wasn't the way to do it, in my humble opinion. And I'd been on that ground a while, and I just felt I knew better. And as a rule of thumb, I think it's much better to attack downhill than uphill anyway. So, and that's, I did tell him that at the end. I said, sure, I'd like to attack downhill for a change. That'd be nice. And he just kind of smiled, you know. But I was dealing with a pro. I don't know whether I would have done that with some of the others or not. I don't know. I can't say. I don't know whether they would have listened. But I have a tendency to think at least most of the seniors I dealt with over there would have listened. It seemed to me a General Davis, he'd listen.
Yeah.
And he had a sense of humor, and he knew guys. He understood you. I'll put it that way. He didn't know. He understood you. You're out there. You're filthy. You're dirty. You smell bad. He'd been there. He understands all that. And he was there one day. I was talking to him on this. It was on that road up in the DMZ. And his helicopter, of course, attracted some enemy attention, and they're wailing away trying with the artillery trying to find the LZ, which was right next to this road, which we were about 25 yards, 30 yards down the road. And I just stood there, looked at the ground, you know, looked up at him, and he said, what's the matter, son? And I said, I'm trying to grow up to be an old man, and you're permitting it. And laughed at him. And he just laughed back. But, any case. No, and you deal with some seniors who are weak, and some who are stupid, and some who drink too much. And I dealt with all of that. And, you have to accomplish the mission, and you have to be loyal to your troops, and you got to make those two work somehow. And if you can't make it work and it doesn't happen, then maybe you're not going to sleep for a while. And maybe, on the other hand, your mind will get through it all. It wasn't your fault.
Well, you know what, Jarvis, obviously, then you're in the wrong line of business. Okay, because I used to do a thing at IOC when I taught there. And it was on the first day I teach my decision-making class, and I asked, the lieutenants a question. Tell me what special trust and confidence means. And you get the standard response, well, sir, Congress, and I would, as an attention getter, and you can imagine how much lieutenants love this, I used to say, fuck Congress. Didn't have anything to do with them, right? And the lieutenants, they'd look around like, God, IOC is the coolest place. This captain just said, fuck Congress. And so... So at some point, one of the second lieutenants would say, it's your bond with the American people. Bingo. You get their son. You get their husband. You get their nephew. Yeah. You get their cousin. And whether they may get him back to put more pictures on their mantle in Dubuque, Iowa, of that kid, the last picture of which they have is him in his dress blues in front of an American flag, maybe a function of your ability to lead. Are you up for it? Are you up for it? And then, exactly, and then the response I would get after that, and I've gotten it years later, Jarvis, was, hey, sir, do you remember? And I said, yeah. I've never forgotten the graphic image that you put in my head that day of my obligation to my Marines. That special trust and confidence is not about you in your dress blues doing a sword arch for one of your friends' wedding. It's those families that trust in you, that you will be the custodian of the life of their son, their daughter, brother, sister, mother, father. And are you up for that? Will you shrink from Bob Barrow when the time comes to say, hey, sir, I think your opso's got this wrong. Here's how I'd like to do it. And if you do that, you will be able to put your head on your pillow and live the rest of your life. And knowing that the consequences weren't good, but that you did what you were supposed to do. And Jarvis, is there a more cruel fate than to not stand up and say the right thing? Know that people died because you didn't do that, and nobody can lift that burden from you for eternity. Is there a crueler fate than that?
The only one I can think of is you're right. There is probably no crueler fate, but one that would haunt me to my dying days would be if I, through stupidity or cowardice, I myself, forget any seniors or anything, had caused the death of troops. Because I didn't know my profession,
right.
Or because I didn't have the moral courage to go through with it.
But I think, and we're talking about the same thing, when you're culpable, and you should have been better, you could have worked harder, you could have stood up and had more balls and looked at somebody and told them the truth. When you could have done that, and you don't do it, and you have to live with that for the rest of your life, that is a fate that is the most, no glass of scotch or bourbon can ever rescue you from that. And that's the moral imperative of leadership in life and death situation. And it is that way, not for just majors, opsos, company commanders. When you become a fire team leader, that is your moral responsibility to look at somebody and say, hey, I think this is fucked up. And either you're going to get the explanation, they're going to take into account your point of view that they may or may not know, and then at some point you're going to get told to shut up and color, and then your job is to make it as good as you could make it. And that's how it works. That's as good as it gets in those situations.
Yeah. Tough business.
It is a tough business, and it's designed for tough leaders, smart leaders, head-in-the-game leaders, leaders that aren't afraid to look at that Medal of Honor winners and Navy Cross winners and tell them the truth. And, Jarvis, first of all, thank you for coming on and discussing this with me, because I think these are the kind of discussions that young leaders need to hear, situations that are real, that you do get put into, and what do you do? How do you make it make sense? You know, and thank you very much for doing it this morning. Another question before I let you go, is there anything about LZ Margo and 2nd Battalion, 26 Marines, that you want to tell us before that I wasn't smart enough to ask you?
No, I think not. I will say that those troops were as good as any America has ever fielded anywhere. They were everyday guys. They were tough. They were strong. They didn't back down. They didn't back down from anybody. And I always said to that battalion, I used to tell the guys, we're not the best battalion around. What we got to be sure of is that nobody is better than we are. And if we do find somebody better than us, he better be on the other side, or better be on our side rather than the other side. But no, it was all the respect in the world for those troops, for what they do, what they did, and for what they put up with after they came home. And God bless them all. And I'll talk to you later, Mac. We're having the LZ Margo keeps coming back. And now there's an effort being fired up to have another reunion. Somebody went over there on a trip, found a set of dog tags. The dog tags belonged to a guy who was killed in the DMZ after Margo, but he'd been at Margo and whatever. So it keeps coming back. And the guys, it's like a magnet for these guys.
Well, I mean, for all of us, those experiences in your life are the most intense. The friendships and what you share, you know, you mentioned a mortarman walking through with a crate of 81, you know, millimeter mortar ammunition over his shoulder, whistling. You know, he got back to his mortar, you know, to his mortar pit, threw that down, and I'm sure had a pretty pointed conversation with his friends. Yes, I mean, and those kind of friendships that will last you forever are what you're talking about, and they endure. They endured like nothing.
Yeah.
So, first of all, again, thank you very much for doing this and being the third installment of Battlefield Study. I appreciate it.
Well, I hope it was some help to some young officers, okay?
All right, sir. First of all, tell your wife thanks for her patience.
Okay. She's abandoned me. She's out someplace shopping, I guess. Probably has my wallet with her.
Well, there you go. There you go.
Have
all right.
Okay, guys.
Thanks,
Mike. Thank you much, Mike.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. That'll do it on a Wednesday. A little bit longer show than normal, but I don't care. The conversations that, you know, privileged to have with guys like Jarvis Lynch, and the way they share their thoughts, and especially in difficult moments, is certainly worth the extra time. And again, I just want to thank him. Can't say thank you enough to all these guys that come on and you know, what's interesting is how willing they are to do it and to talk about it and hopefully convert, you know, the blood and sweat of their Marines into a lesson learned so that somebody's smarter the next time that they go down range. And so very, very cool. Their willingness, their desire to be thorough and be good. And so, again, I love doing it. My thanks to Jim Bathurst, who came on. You'll hear him. If you're just joining us, you'll hear him in about 30 minutes after we check some news headlines. And then you'll hear Sergeant Bathurst talking about NCO leadership. So Wednesday becoming favorite day of the week here. And then after that, You'll hear Jarvis Lynch. If you caught the tail end of it, you'll hear it from its inception. Also, just a programming note, tomorrow you're going to hear about the kind of the experiment the Marine Corps did. And the initiative was called Sea Dragon 2025, centered around technology and different configurations of the Marine Corps rifle squad. So the one of the company commanders involved in that going to join us tomorrow, Joe Patterson. He was Kilo 3-5, and he's going to kind of walk us through what the Marine Corps did, what the Marine Corps looked at, and give his thoughts on that. So looking forward to that. Have a great afternoon. We'll see you tomorrow on a Thursday. Take care. All Marine 8 Radio. Out.